Hello everyone. It's been a while, but it's all for good. You're welcome to another edition of Breakout with BD. I must admit that the reason we were off air for a while was to regroup. We wanted to see how we could do things better here and at the same time work together to achieve our aspiration of a violence and abuse-free world for children. This week's show is going to be exciting and I promise you that you will be at the edge of your seats. Kicking off the show is our topic of today, which is the future of the street kid in fostering and adoption. Now, most times our perception of street children is one that is most certainly disturbing. We judge them as the thieves and criminals in our neighborhoods. We conclude that when you are looking for a societal nuisance, you look at those kids first. Now, true to it, many of these destitute kids can beg the living daylight out of you. They beg for money. Sometimes they beg for the items on you, like your lunch, wristwatches, your clothes, and so on. Some of them are more daring and will resort to violence or crime in their bid to survive. While I am not an advocate for these behaviors, one thing we fail to realize, however, is that millions of these children, some as young as 5 years of age, leave work and must learn to survive on the streets. Some of them work, play, and spend most of their days with other children walking on the street. But they have families to return to at night. Others survive entirely on their own, except for the company of other street children. And I wonder why these kids would not live up to our reputation and even become a bigger menace or nuisance. Now, looking at the brighter side, though, I remember my experience with one of them in southern Nigeria. She was a little girl from Niger Republic who kept begging me for my food. And when I voluntarily gave her all that was left, she decided to pay for that food by performing a Nigerian song called Fuji for me. Now, for all my African and Nigerian listeners, some of you may already know what I mean by Fuji. And I tell you, I have never seen that song more beautifully performed by anyone, especially a non-Nigerian. Since we are used to tagging these kids as our headaches and nightmares, I think it's time for us to start creating sustainable solutions to the problems that they create on the street. No child should be on the street. And that's the truth. What is the hope of fostering these little ones? What about adopting them? How about expanding the capacities of our orphanages? Joining me to talk more about this are two wonderful people. We have the first person. His name is Mr. Emmanuel Adaramola. He is the founder of a non-governmental organization in Nigeria called the Emmanuel World Children Foundation. One of their services is making life better for the disadvantaged children, such as the street kids, and also reaching out to them and helping take them off the streets. My second guest is Peggy Kirby from the Louisiana Foster and Adoptive Parent Association. It's a non-profit organization that was created to serve foster parents, adoptive parents, and the children in their care by providing communication, support, training, and advocacy services. Now, I would like to welcome both of you to the show. Hi there, Peggy.
Hi, how are you? Hi, Benimi.
Hi, Peggy. How are you doing?
I'm fine, thank you.
And you're welcome on the show.
Thank you for having me.
All right, and Mr. Emmanuel, you're also welcome on the show.
Thank you very much. Good evening.
Now, I'm going to start with Emmanuel. I checked your website where I saw one of the reasons for the existence of your organization. Now, can you tell us one of the things that you do to make life better for a street child?
Thank you very much, BDB. You know, there are key things that the street kids need: rescue and then rehabilitation. For us, we call it double R, rescue and rehabilitation. The third R, which used to come later, is reintegration back into the society. So these are the three key things that we do in our organization. But prominent of it is rescuing the child on the street, taking them off the street, then into rehabilitation program.
Thank you very much, Emmanuel. Now, Peggy.
Yes.
I love one of the aspects of the organization's vision, which talks about strengthening family relationships. Briefly tell us what that is about.
Our Foster Parent Association represents the foster parents within our state, and we want to help strengthen them by giving them the support that we need and making sure that they are educated on the needs of their children that they're caring for.
Okay. Yeah. Would you like to add something?
Yes, ma'am. We sponsor education conferences each year. We reach out to the foster parents through newsletter, and we offer scholarships to the children in their care. So we do a wide range of things within the state of Louisiana.
Okay, and all of that would help build a stronger family foundation, I guess?
For the children, yes, ma'am, that come into care, into foster care.
Okay, if you still for you. Now, talking about strengthening family relationships, where there is an absence of that, we have a dysfunctional family system from which many street children are produced. Now, what is the probability of restoring the faith and confidence of these children, and especially kids from these kinds of dysfunctional homes, in fostering and adoption? Don't you think the children might just feel all families are the same?
Yes, ma'am. We see that all the time. The children come to us sometime not knowing what a functional family is. All they've seen their whole life may have been neglect and abuse and perhaps drugs and alcohol, an abusive father, an abusive mother, and they come into our homes not knowing what to expect. And that's part of the task that we take on, is allowing these children to feel a normalcy in a family, to realize what family really is.
That's really a very big challenge, you know, especially for a broken child, you know.
Yes, ma'am. A lot of times it takes a while to help the child get over. We don't expect miracles when they first come into our home. Sometimes it takes 3 to 6 months for that child to even accept their placement within our home.
Now, my next question is for Emmanuel. Can you just briefly tell us the dangers and difficulties faced by children on the street?
Wow, that's a very big question, because when you're looking at the dangers faced on the street, it's very, very enormous. This starts even from the day one on the street. You know, like from my own experience of working with street kids for about 15 years now, I realized that a day on the street, it's past proportional to about 7 days at home. When you work in rehabilitation of a child for 7 days and that child again back to the street for a day, it's wiped away 7 days of rehabilitation process. And so this is because of the danger they are exposed to on the street. This starts from bullying from the older boys or girls on the streets. This also coupled with exposure to health hazards, accident on the road. And then in an economy, especially in Africa, where we have a lot of developing and emerging economy, you realize that a lot of kids have to fend for themselves. Even those ones at home, talk less of the ones on the street. And so in the process of fending for themselves, they are also exposed to a lot of hazard and danger, which includes kidnapping, issues, using for rituals, and then exploitation and abuse. Mm. These are all there. And a lot of time also, they also get involved in crime. Mm. Then again, they get involved in drug addictions, drug abuse, and some other things. So this now make it much more difficult for them. And then they would now try to leave. And then they now get themselves more into this. That is to the kids themselves. Mm. Now, when you look at the danger of that are the area that now affects the community, the people, and others who now realize that a lot of these kids, they now vent their anger, their negative emotion back on the society. They attack people, attack other children, attack or break people's car. And there was a case sometimes ago of a child that we were working with. And then at a point on the street, I realized that in the night, when he was on the street, in the night, he woke up at around 1 a.m. and started throwing stone to street lights, breaking street lights. Then at a point in time, I asked him, I said, why are you doing this? He said, those lights are not meant for me. It is meant for good people. I am a bad boy. And so I need to break it to show to them that, well, I don't need it.
I really don't give a damn.
I don't really care. And so, in that is just going to get back to the society, destroying public property. That is one of the hazards again to the community. Mm-hmm. Talk less of a lot of other things. And then they lose education, no future. A lot of them get pregnant, girls get pregnant on the street, mm-hmm. have babies on the street, and then the cycle again continues. The challenges and problems are enormous.
This is certainly a disturbing trend. You know, I read about the story of a little boy in Indonesia who had his private part, you know, cut off because he refused to join them in forced begging. You know, these are serious issues that face street children. I think we really should, you know, wake up to our responsibilities in helping these kids, you know, get off the dangerous streets. Now, Peggy, yes. Can you please tell us briefly about fostering and adoption and how you think street children should be incorporated into these solutions?
Well, it's difficult to incorporate street children into the category of foster and adoptive children because they still have parents. Many of them still have parents and they have parental rights. And in the States, we wouldn't consider these children as street children because they may still have a caregiver or legal guardian regardless of the quality of the caregiver. And so in some local communities, they may be considered as a population of street children, but not as a state issue. If we suspect a child is in an unhealthy environment, either living at home or on the street, you should call your child protection agency, if you have one, and let them do the investigation and bring that child into care.
Emmanuel, can you tell us the African version of this question I asked Peggy? And what I mean by that is, what is fostering and adoption like in Africa? And will street children who have no relationship whatsoever with their available African families ever be welcomed into those families?
Well, Bidemi, you know, one thing that is very clear, I always tell people everywhere I have opportunity of speaking all over the globe, I said, African fostering has always been part of us in Africa. Because in Africa, there's this adage that says, it is only a person that give birth to a child. It is 200 people that take care of that child. That is in community response. So in Africa, we have this community response that take care of orphans, vulnerable children, street children, abandoned children, disadvantaged children, abused children. But in recent time, the trend of things is now making things more difficult for the kids because families now don't have enough economic strength to take care of themselves, talk less of taking care of more children. And so the fostering aspect now is now becoming more of a legal issue, unlike the way it used to be a community response before. And so looking at it now in Africa, gradually with the emergence of the Child's Rights Act and is now making it more public, and then people are becoming aware about it. And then the court is now coming alive in that regard, because then the court was not doing much in this regard because there's this community response. But because of poverty and economic issues, that is not being put in place now. People are, and the court is now trying to get things done. And so for street children, there is still a lot of ample opportunity, though the economic factor is there, which is limiting people taking in children, fostering children, and the likes. But then, with some of the works that my organization has been doing, and then with some other organizations, I know of Ghana, I know of an organization in Uganda that also has been doing it. They take up the child, but for the first 6 months, the child stays in the home, in the shelter. And then working with the child in the process of rehabilitation, character molding, moral development, and every other thing. By the time they now realize that the child can now live well within a family, at that point in time, they now approach the court. And then when the family comes out that they want to foster the child, then they go through the process in the court and then foster the child out. Though today, a lot of people are not aware of that process, but it's gradually emerging in African culture.
That's a better, because, you know, when Peggy said it's difficult to incorporate street children into fostering and adoption, it's really something that got me very concerned. And I think it should get a lot of people, especially our government, our legal systems, our judicial systems, it really should get them concerned. We should find a way to incorporate street children into fostering and adoption, apart from other things like orphanages, because this would help reduce the number of children that stay, you know, on the street. Now, my next question is for Peggy. I know that recently in the United States, the alarming rate of homeless youths has been a source of major concern. Now, in your opinion, do you envisage a shortage of willing and capable foster or adoptive adults or parents for these teenagers in the future?
Yes, I do. And I wanted to clarify something on the past question. In the United States, fostering is temporary care for children while the agency works with their parents to solve the problem so they can be reunited as a family. That's our number one priority. Adoption is a permanent home with a new family after these problems cannot be resolved. And so I did want to clarify that. But yes, I do see a shortage of willing and capable foster adoptive parents because the economic difficulties and struggles to maintain their own biological families, and it makes it more difficult to take in and care for needy children.
Okay. So with this threat in mind, I don't know what to think. And my listeners, I wonder what they are thinking as I speak. But this is still for you, Peggy. Now, fostering and adoption of children is supposed to give them a stable environment to heal and grow up as responsible adults. Now, when this fails, what next?
What next? Well, the child goes back into the child protection system here in the United States, and the family with a relative of their family who can help care for the child. If they're fostering the child goes back into the social services system, and the system just looks for another foster home. A lot of problems that we're seeing is some of the children cannot be maintained in a functional family because they're so unused to it. They're so abused and neglected that they can't function in a family home, and they have to be put into residential placements or with another foster family. And one of the problems that we're running into here is that when that child turns 18, they're a legal adult. They're no longer in foster care. And a lot of them haven't established a place to go at 18, but the system releases them from care because they become a legal adult. So that's a lot of the problems that we're seeing now with the children.
And when the system releases them, you know, what happens to them, you know, when they're out there, when they're out of the protective shield of the system, what happens to them out there?
Many of them become homeless. They shift from one friend's house to another friend's house. Many of them wind up incarcerated in jail, bouncing from pillar to post. Very few of them are successful. That's the reason we as foster parents accept the challenge to try and prepare these children for independent living when they turn 18. Myself, I'm a specialized foster parent who works with teenage girls, getting them ready for independence for when they turn 18. They'll have somewhere to go, yet they can rely on themselves and won't have to fall back into the system of abuse and neglect.
All right, Peggy, I apologize. I'm going to take you back to that question. I'm talking about incorporating street children into adoption and fostering. Now, I really want my listeners to have a better view and grasp of this question. Does it mean no street child can ever be fostered or adopted?
No, ma'am, that's not what it means. An individual can take a child in off the street without going through the system. If your heart is in it, then that's really what you should do. But if you're working within the system that we have here, the social services system, if you see a child on the street, they should be reported to the social service system so we can bring them into the system, get them medical, dental care, help them with their education, and get them prepared. And so that's what I meant a while ago when I said that street children could not be incorporated. I meant they would have to come through the system to be considered foster children.
Yeah, for my listeners, it's important we know that's now, Peggy, you are saying something.
Yes, I was saying something, and forgive me, I've lost that train of thought, but the street children need to be reported to the social services so they can be brought into the system to help.
Okay, and I think I was saying that the process of you know, getting the kids into the social system and getting them off the street should be taken more seriously by our government, and also adopted by other countries that don't do things, similar things like this. I think this particular solution is not present in Africa, and a country like Nigeria with thousands of kids that, you know, that loiter on the streets without families to turn back to. My last question will go to Emmanuel. Now, as individuals, what should be our roles in ensuring that we assist street kids and take as many of them off the streets, even when we are not ready or capable or empowered to be foster or adoptive parents?
Thank you very much, Peter. Let me just quickly clear something about your last statement that talking about Nigeria and Africa, that we don't have the social system. You are right. We don't have the structured and the institutionalized fostering system yet. But it's emerging gradually. But then there are some other areas where fostering, not written in black and white, is being practiced. I know different communities have different way of handling issues like that. There are some communities that there is no way a child will sleep outside the street. It is the community people that will take it up and begin to find out who is the parent of this child. Mm-hmm. That is going on, I mean, clearly. Although in some of the big towns and cities in the old area, you see a lot of other children. Like when you come into Lagos, you see a lot of things there. When you get down to Addis Ababa, you see the children there. Recently also, Kenya is having a big challenge. There's a recent increase in the number of kids on the street, especially in Nairobi. Nairobi recently, I mean, the statistics say they have about 60,000 children on the street in Nairobi alone. And so when you look at this, there is need for every hand to come together. As we are exploring the traditional or the cultural way of fostering these children, then we also have to explore the legal or the institutional aspect, that is the social welfare system. Different ministry, different government have social welfare system, but it is not really looking into this. I know some states have rehabilitation homes. They have children's homes and different things like that, transit homes, that these children comes in over a period, though this really, really need to be strengthened, need to be expanded to bring in more children. That is one area. Then secondly, for me as a person, when you look at the statistics all over the globe, all over the world, It is not only, even in the United States, with some of the statistics, like what Peggy was saying, you see some children that, because of their exposure, they could not even live and stay within the usual forced at home. They now stay in institution, in home, and then the cycle continues. So it's also going on in Europe. Like, if you get down to Europe, you see the statistics also is alarming. And that is the reason why, for me as a person, we need to begin to look at the community system. A community system whereby we have home, we have this, but within the community setup, we try to make children more convenient, more conducive, and then we create a kind of structure for them, system for them, whereby everybody can contribute. Mm-hmm. Everybody can participate. Mm-hmm. Either you are the foster parent or not, when there is a child that is in need, then if you can come in, even if it is providing psychosocial support, counseling, providing games, recreation, if that is what you can do for this child, do it. If this one can provide religious instructions, moral development, do it. If this one can provide academics, education, extra lessons, do it. Mm. If this one can provide health, alternative medicine, do it. That is involving everybody, not leaving it for government. Because in countries where they have seen it as government responsibility, they are even failing. That is a reality. And so when you are looking at it again, that they are looking at the community alone, it's also failing. But now it needs a cohesive effort of everybody. Religious institutions, associations, charity organizations, everybody, individual philanthropists needs to put hands together. Because for me as a person, in my year of working with street kids, I realized that it is not only given education that will make that child off the street. There are some areas that require religious instructions. There are some children that their background is religious background. And so when you come to that time, using the angle of religion, it works more with such child. There are some children that from their own, they are from rural community, they are exposed, they know more about farming and different other things. When you now begin to use that as a kind of entry point into their lives, it works more. I have a guy, he's now a graduate. The father died when he was 4 years. The mother died also when he was, I think, about 9 years. And he trekked almost about 300 kilometers to get to the city at the age of 10 plus. And he lived on the street again for 10 and a half years. But today he's a graduate. He's on his own. He has a furniture company. But then it took us about 3 solid months, years, before getting to the heart of this particular child. In between, he went to prison twice. But at the end of the day, today he's a better person in the society, even giving back to the society. But we explore the religious interventions, we explore the moral, we explore the philanthropy, we explore education, we explore technical and every other thing. So it has to be an all-encompassing. Yeah, but I think our viewers need, our listeners really need to understand this. It is more we begin to concentrate more on prevention than on treatment.
Oh, this is fantastic. Prevention is better than cure. That's what some people say. I think I believe it. Peggy, do you have any parting words?
Yes, I totally agree with the other guests. I think we should work with our community entities who have programs for such children and to help establish programs for children. In the United States, we do not have the thousands of children on the street as street children, to my knowledge. I know there are some, but a lot of them are homeless, though, still living with their parents. And we still try and reach out to those children. We do have a social services system in the United States. We are trying to work an improvement to where we can reach out and touch more children. Yes, religious and moral upbringing and teaching is what these children need to help them be functional adults when they age out.
Thank you, Peggy. I'd like to thank Emmanuel and Peggy for their wonderful contributions to this sensitive topic. Street children need our love and our support. Leaving them on the streets will only multiply them and the problems associated with them. Some of these kids even get pregnant after being raped or sexually exploited. And if you remember what my guest Emmanuel said, this cycle continues. Street kids giving birth to more street kids. Now, irrespective of the ages or sizes of these children, they should be in a normal and stable home. A street can be nuisance and crime-free if we rise up to the challenge of reaching out to these kids. I like this statement, catch them young, but I'd rather say catch them all. Every street child can be a normal child with prospects of having a better future as an adult and equally being a fantastic parent and citizen of his or her country. But this is all up to us to make this happen. Once again, I'd like to thank you, Emmanuel.
Thank you very much,
and thank you, Emmanuel. I'd like to thank you, Peggy, too, for your time.
Thank you, Bademi. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you, too. Now, we'll be right back after this break. Do not go anywhere. Welcome back to Breakout with BD. I'm excited to have you back. And we're going to be moving on to our next segment, and that is on the job again. Now, today we'll be looking at something very exciting, and I call it managing today's angry workforce. Now, I would have to apologize here because my guest who was supposed to appear on the show today seemed to have other engagements, and apologized for his inability to come for this show. So please bear with us. We're just going to look at this topic. We'll treat it like an editorial or kind of sharing our opinion on it. So I'm going to share my opinion with you on this. And like, you know, this is a live show. If you'd want to share your thoughts and opinion on this as well, you can call in and do so. Now, what exactly is managing today's angry workforce? all about. And before we begin to look at that, we need to understand that shareholders, board members, and other stakeholders in the organization always expect corporate growth. Now, the past recession created the much sought-after opportunity for many organization top management to cut back on their employees and increase profitability. More so, since there were no available options to explore in meeting targets of profit and cost reduction, these actions seemed like the best thing to do. Where jobs are plentiful, employees move on to seek greener pastures, but this is not the case today. Some of the lucky employees whose jobs proved to be recession-proof now feel stuck in the organization. These ones tend to act emotionally with endless complaints, angry outbursts, and might even fist fight their colleagues when agitated. Now, in very severe forms of this emotional state, we have issues, and we have this issue of what is called bossicides, and this is where employees actually go all out and have their bosses killed. Now, this is a breaking point where these employees, you know, or the staff members just snap, and I don't think an organization should get to that point before beginning to really look at the severity of managing the angry workforce in an organization. Now, the basic root of this whole talk is anger, and is also the basic root of conflict and violence in the workplace. And while conflict and anger are really not new to the workplace, what's new is when it's unresolved or unchecked. Now, studies have shown that this has a significant and extra cost implication to the organization. For instance, it could be associated with absenteeism, fines, higher insurance premiums, legal fees, and even high employee turnover. More disturbingly, it can spill into the home front by manifesting in families and communities. It may result in harm that is inner directed, which manifests through behavior to oneself. And we have people with that kind of behavior becoming suicidal. Sometimes they become very reckless. Some of them abuse drug and alcohol. Some of them go through very severe depression and many other, you know, dangerous lifestyles that some of them begin to embrace as a result of anger and conflict that has been unresolved or unchecked in their workplaces. Now, it can also be outer directed, and that would manifest through behaviors to others, such as threats, emotional or verbal abuse, bullying, harassment, assaults. You're welcome back on the show. I apologize for that short hitch. It was a result of the internet connection. And like I was saying, some of these behaviors can also be outer directed, which manifests through behaviors to others, such as threats, emotional or verbal abuse, bullying, harassment, assaults, domestic violence, and the expression of rage. The victims of these harmful behaviors are usually women and children. Now, what would make an employee snap? What would make an employee be angry or be conflict and anger prone? Now, the thing about conflict is there's conflict when there is difference, or when there's a difference in our wants, in our needs, and expectations in the workplace. That's when you have conflict and anger. And a lot of things could bring about anger to lower level staff, middle level staff, or the top management staff. Now, what could anger a supervisor and manager might be different from what would anger his or her subordinates, and might be different from what would anger the management or above him. Now, usually what would anger people in middle management and those in the active part of the organizational work will be things like the threat of a job loss or downsizing. We also have things like disempowerment of staff, where a staff actually loses control over the job he or she is supposed to do. We also have this pressure to do more and more, but with less or loss of existing resources. So these are some of the factors that can actually create a high stress condition at the workplace. Now, every organization should have their own peculiar way of managing heightened anxiety among their staff. Sometimes A conflict could even arise as a result of bad performance evaluation. So we need to really be, as the management of an organization, we really need to look out for our staff, to look out for our processes, our culture, and things like that, to ensure that the nuts and screws are in the right places and people are doing what they're supposed to do and they're following the laid out policies, you know, of the organization. Now, in many organizations, especially in Africa, we have a lack of psychologists. And with the lack of psychologists, we have this absence of anger management training. Now, this kind of training is really important in an organization, and I mean anger management training. Every staff should go through it because we all have the tendencies to really lose our cool when we are going through a tough time or another. Now, when anger is unresolved or unchecked, usually it will lead to violence. And I was reading an article recently where a lady, she was one of the top management of that organization, but she said that she felt it's the right thing to do for top management to get or receive reports of violence from managers and supervisors so that they can know how to fix that problem. So she's preferring that managers and supervisors of workplaces begin to report workplace violence out annually to top management so that top management can really sit up on this problem and do something about it, because when they don't, it has a very high cost implication to them. It's more expensive and it makes an organization, you know, lose money when you have unresolved conflict within the organization. Now, as much as I would like to talk more about issues with respect to managing today's angry workforce, I need us to know that this issue has gone beyond, you know, the reactive approach. Now, we don't really need to wait for our staff to snap before top management waits in. The best approach by organizations should be, you know, a proactive one. Now, anger in the workplace is a signal that something is wrong with the company's culture. Every organization has a culture. So when there's anger, it's a signal that something is wrong with that culture. It's a signal that something is not right. Now, it's the responsibility of management to investigate this and seek effective solutions. And they should not forget to go beyond spelling out policies on management's expectation when it comes to angry and violent conduct at the workplace. It's time for management to show a zero tolerance for violence or other harmful behavior at work. Management must deal decisively and sternly with all violations. This will be all that I will be able to say on managing today's angry workforce. I hope you learned a thing or two about this, and I hope we all would do what is right and ensure that our workplaces are safe and anger management is in place for our staff, and employers of labor also know what to do to ensure that violence is not tolerated or any other harmful behavior is not tolerated in the workplace. That will be all that we'll be able to take, and I will join you after this break. Welcome back to the show. Our other segment is going to start, and that's News on Breakout. We might not be able to take much, but I will tell you that there is a very serious food crisis in Eastern Africa, and this has been dubbed the disaster of the century. Now, this food crisis is caused by drought, chaos, crisis, and the refusal of a militant terrorist group called Al-Shabaab in allowing humanitarian assistance to reach people in that area. Kenya recently complained about the shortage of resources to hand out to refugees who have come to seek solace and protection from Somalia. And this has really... You're welcome back to Breakout with BD. This has really been a very, very... I'll call it a wonderful show, but you must bear with me. I have no control over the quality of the internet connection, so I wish it was better, but I will do my best, you know, and I hope you understand. Now, I was talking about news on Breakout, and I said the food crisis in Eastern Africa has been dubbed the disaster of the century. It has been caused by drought, chaos and crisis in that country, and the refusal of a militant terrorist group called Al-Shabaab in allowing humanitarian assistance to reach people in the area. Now, many women and children have died as a result of malnutrition or outright starvation. Kenya recently complained about the shortage of her country's of her resources in taking care and accommodating refugees from Somalia. And these countries in Eastern Africa has been under a lot of fighting and conflicts. It's been basically a war zone, and with a lot of terrorism going on there, the safety of women and especially children has remained something of utmost concern to the international community. So I would just like to use this to as a kind of plea to the government, to the people listening. We have a lot of people who are trying to reach out to people in this part of Africa. And if you know of a group or an organization that is trying to do something to help provide food and assist the people, the refugees in this area, please don't forget to give them your widow's mite. Just give a little something so that a child out there will not starve to death. And that'll be all I'll be able to take on news on Breakout. We are coming to the last segment of the show, and that is my, in fact, that's where I love to celebrate the most. And I tag this segment Angels on a Mission. And today we will be celebrating the Tanzanian Children's Fund. Now, this is a non-profit organization that provides support for orphaned and vulnerable children in northern Tanzania. They also provide financial support to programs designed to improve the lives of marginalized children in Tanzania. Currently, it's working in partnership with the Rift Valley Children's Fund, a non-governmental organization organized under the laws of Tanzania. As part of the services of the Tanzanian Children's Fund, it has created the Rift Valley Children's Village, and this has served as a home and shelter for more than 70 orphans and has also helped provide primary school education for more than 450 children in that area. And furthermore, there are children who live in that area that have alcoholic parents. Some of them have cases of physical or sexual abuse. Some of them have issues with lack of food and sometimes have no place to sleep at night. Now, this organization, I'm still talking about the Tanzanian Children's Fund, this organization works with the village leaders and the local Tanzanian officials to make decisions regarding the children. Now, eventually, these issues are handled at the community level. And I tell you, what better way to make an impact than going to the grassroots? I really, really want to commend this organization for the beautiful work they are doing. I want to commend the founder and the dedication of the staff. So on behalf of myself and my team, we say thank you to Angel India Howell, who is the founder of the Tanzanian Children's Fund, and all her dedicated team of staff. You guys are the bomb, and you are doing a splendid job. God bless you. So, guys, this is how far we'll be able to go today. Thank you for joining me on the show. I really must apologize for my breezing in and out of the show. Like I said, it's as a result of the internet connection, which I really have no control over. But, you know, things only get better. So I'm looking at the brighter side. I'm optimistic that things will only get better here. And next week, we'll be looking at the relationship between poverty and child abuse. And for topics of discussions on our other segments, I can only promise you that it will blow your mind. I love you guys. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.